Welcome to the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast, where we discuss the world of IT and cybersecurity. Don't be left in the dark about what's going on in the world around you. Here is your host, Joe Gray.
Welcome to the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast. I'm Joe Gray. With me this illustrious evening is Ed Porter. Ed is a freelance information security professional in the Atlanta metro area. He spends a lot of time evangelizing information security to various parties to make the internet a safer place here in Atlanta. He's very active within the ISSA chapter. He's got a lot of really good certifications such as CISSP, Security Plus, and Linux Plus. And, you know, I'm happy to have you here, Ed. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm stoked to be here.
Awesome. Tell us a little bit more about yourself, and then we'll get started with the news.
Well, I have a technical background. I have always been an enthusiast for technology and networking, and much more recently, security. And so that's kind of the angle I'm trying to best apply myself. You know, we've got a very dangerous world, and I feel like the world needs people like you and me to make it a safer place.
I couldn't agree more. You know, in all reality, we need to just evangelize security, integrate it into people's daily lives, and work through it. You know, the threat is not going to go away, as demonstrated via the Mirai distributed denial of service attacks on Brian Krebs and on Den. But, mm-hmm. You know, it's just further fuel to the fire to really evangelize security, and more importantly, evangelize doing security right.
Absolutely.
So with that being said, let's go ahead and transition into the news. We've got a couple of articles that you picked out, both from ThreatPost. I will put links in the show notes. We'll start with the lighter note of the two, and that is Signal. Signal app has been audited, and according to the academics behind it, which I'm quoting directly out of the ThreatPost article, were from Oxford, Queensland University of Technology in Australia, Canada's McMaster University, and I believe that's it. They have ruled it as cryptographically sound. They've done the same with WhatsApp and Google's Allo. So Signal, the protocol, is actually the underlying thing behind WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, and Allo. So, you know, what are your thoughts on Signal?
Well, I haven't been a Signal user. I have seen the Allo app, but you know, I don't have a lot of friends on these things, so I haven't gotten into the habit of using these. But I definitely am looking forward to, you know, security being a more default sort of, you know, on by default kind of situation. And, you know, I think iMessage really paved the way for this. And I think the more of these, the better, because people need this kind of security. But I think also it's important that, people understand that, you know, this isn't going away. And, you know, I know that there's some controversy around, you know, should the government be able to see into these types of communications. I think that this is just a continuation of the trend of, you know, securing everything by default. So this is really the only way people will be able to use security on a regular basis in a way that's not, you know, dangerous, or in a way that is, you know, they're not mistakenly, you know, using it and doing it poorly.
So you mean to tell me that right now there are things that you can purchase and implement that are not secure?
I mean, I think most of our online chats aren't secure. So this would be, you know, taking a good step in that direction.
And, you know, honestly, I couldn't agree more, because the reality is things are, in the past, organizations have created products and they have not had the security in mind. They've basically been, I'm going to steal from Michael Santarcangelo and Paul Asadorian and their Startup Security Weekly momentarily and say, you know, they're worried about the minimal viable product and they completely forget about minimal viable security. The problem is now, especially with the Internet of Things, the lifetime of replacement of some of these things is so long that the problem will never be solved. When you're talking about things like refrigerators, for example, they have a lifetime of like 25 years. Mm-hmm. You know, baby monitors, assuming a couple has, say, three children, from the time the first kid's born until the last one is, you know, beyond the age of needing a baby monitor, let's just say 5 years old for whatever reason, assuming they have about a year and a half or even a 3 year difference between each, at that point, you only need it for 11 years. Realistically, unless there's some significant bell and whistle, there's no reason to get a new one between children.
Yeah, I mean, the main units themselves, I could definitely see them not being replaced, like you said, with a refrigerator. But if the, you know, the Internet of Things aspects of these appliances are made with a more modular sort of approach, I think that you know, they could design it with a future future security in mind, where things would be actually replaced after a few years, because it seems like you know, it's a lost cause to expect updates to actually be provided, you know, years into a product's life. So, you know, if the actual hardware were able to be you know, taken out and replaced, I think that would be the only potential solution that I could see.
Well, refurbishing the hardware, that's definitely a sound solution. Another solution would be the ability to update the firmware. And then alternatively, better network segmentation. And I'm not going to point the finger exclusively at the Internet of Things manufacturers, because yes, they're responsible. And yes, the consumers are responsible because they continue to buy these things. But the home Wi-Fi or just home router organizations that work in technology, typically they have an arm that is nothing but security. They are allowing these things. You know, when you look at the Internet of Things, it's like, hey, you know, I'm going to open up these ports using UPnP so that my stuff can communicate with me. That's cool until it's Telnet. And it's cool until it opens it with UPnP, but it never closes it. Or because it has default credentials that you cannot change, that you don't even know exist. That's when it becomes problematic. And honestly, you know, I'm working with a few people to develop some ideas for a solution that could be deployed, something that perhaps you could purchase, plug into your wireless router, and then from there create a segmented network for your Internet of Things that would actually provide some level of protection. But until that happens, and until people have that incentive to do so, we're still going to be right back where we are.
Yeah, and that layered defense approach is something that I think a lot of us like to see. And like you said, the segmentation, that's going to be important, just to try to make sure that if something does go wrong, that it's contained and it doesn't affect, you know, anything more than it has to. So, but yeah, like, you know, technology is always going to be changing. I know a good example, I think, is how SSL and the old browsers isn't going to work anymore. And so your old Internet Explorer, you know, just isn't going to be able to communicate with most of the Internet nowadays. And, you know, so in 5 years and 10 years, like, you know, what we're using today with TLS, you know, might not be considered secure anymore. So like I said, the modular approach, where, you know, things of this nature can be updated. And as you said, with the firmware updates, all of this stuff has to be baked in for these devices to be, you know, of any sound security at all, you know, even to just get a baseline.
And I couldn't agree more. But, you know, realistically, another thing that you have to consider is the fact of, in the security world, you don't have to get it right every time. You don't. The phrase goes, you know, if you're the blue team, you have to get it right every time. And if you're the red team, you only have to get it right once. And yes, that is true to some degree. But alternatively, if that were the case, then we would have no need for incident response. So I'm not saying that they need to get things perfect. I'm saying that they need to do it better and have a process for making it better as time goes on, so it can evolve with the times.
Yeah, if they just, you know, bake into the design a lot of this stuff and realize that parts are going to need to be updated, software is going to be found to be vulnerable, and fixes are you know, possible to be put on there. I just know from all the Android devices out there that that have different hardware. I'm sure everybody's seen an Android device that is old and abandoned and can't get updates anymore. So I just, and part of the reason for that, as I understand, is that some of the chips used in the, you know, the boards that are put in these phones, some of them stop being supported and there's no way to update some of those things, and they are left vulnerable. And so you've just got these, you know, devices that are abandoned. And I guess that's my concern with anything that we're sort of calling Internet of Things or any of these things. Like, even if we do come up with firmware updates, or the ability to update many of the firmware things that are going on in hardware, it still is an uphill battle to have developers working on that stuff and available to, you know, fix those flaws and push updates.
Hey, do you want to hear a quick joke about Android?
Sure.
What is the difference between a leap year and an Android update?
I'm not sure. Tell me.
Leap years are guaranteed to happen at least every 4 years.
and that is a frightening situation I think we're setting up for with Android.
I could not agree more. So let's go ahead and shift gears and talk about our other story, which is just recently in Hong Kong, someone at a Chinese University of Hong Kong, a researcher, presented at Black Hat Europe last week that they've been able to sign into 1 billion mobile LAP accounts effortlessly with OAuth 2. And it describes an attack that takes advantage of the poor implementations and puts these apps in jeopardy. So they, you know, to provide a little bit more information about it, they examined 600 top U.S. and Chinese mobile apps that use it, from Facebook, Google, and Sina, which is something Chinese apparently, and they found that 41.2% of the apps were vulnerable to the attack, including popular dating, travel, shopping, hotel booking, finance, chat, music, and news apps. Fortunately, they didn't name any, but I'm sure that that's going to be changing soon. So expect a lot of updates to your smartphones.
Yeah, and I think in our efforts to make everything simple and have single sign-on functionality with everything we do, and you know, everybody hates it, putting in passwords or having to authenticate. That's not going away. We're definitely, you know, full speed ahead into that territory, and this is the kind of stuff that I think really can get scary, combined with, you know, our push for single sign-on and, you know, logging in via Facebook to everything or logging in via Twitter to everything. So, and everybody's, I think that this is probably a really popular thing that people are using. I know I do it, and I sort of feel dirty every time I do it, but, you know, it's something I haven't been able to avoid in certain situations. It's just too convenient. So I'm really afraid of another, you know, app that uses this OAuth type of authentication, you know, becoming vulnerable and compromised. So that would be that's something that's definitely going to be on my radar.
And here's another thing. You know, I've made it very well known to the powers that be that I'm working on some OSINT projects, and in many cases, I'm using Python scripts and API calls based on the work of Justin Seitz and his Python course, which I highly recommend everyone to take. Go to automatingosint.com to sign up. But nonetheless, you know, in the same regard, though, OAuth is an easy way to connect via the API. So in the Python script, you know, you're importing OAuth 2 to authenticate to the API. So imagine, you know, it's so much bigger than all these apps, because think of how many scripts are out there running, collecting OSINT or doing whatever, that is using OAuth 2 to authenticate to the API.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's a ton out there that is using using this, and a ton that just uses Facebook. I would think there's a huge target now on this type of, I guess, single sign-on.
And, you know, I think that that number is not going to go anywhere anytime soon. People are interested in what is easy, not necessarily what is secure.
Oh, absolutely. The security, ease of use, sliding scale, or the needle on that spectrum is way over on the ease of use side with this, and the security is not going to be the primary concern. I think when people want to log into, you know, for instance, Lyft or something like that, if I need a ride somewhere, you know, I need to install that app on my phone. I'm not going to spend a lot of time making sure that I'm logged in properly, or I'm logged in securely. I'm just going to be worried about getting going and getting a ride.
Oh, certainly. So with that being said, let's go ahead and take our first break. And when we come back, we're going to start talking about social engineering and OSINT, specifically from the vein of social engineering, OSINT, and the election. So stay tuned.
Are you looking for a place to advertise to the unique audience of IT security professionals and enthusiasts? Look no further. Advanced Persistent Security is seeking sponsors. This slot could be yours. Contact sales at advancedpersistentsecurity.net for more information.
And we're back from the break. Thank you for sticking around. I most certainly appreciate it. So again, with me this evening is Ed Porter. We've been discussing the news. So we talked a little bit about OAuth 2 vulnerabilities and Signal getting a clean bill of cryptographic health from some leading researchers. Now we're going to shift gears and start to talk a little bit about, and I apologize in advance, the election. Before we get started, the purpose of this is not to talk about Donald Trump, nor is it to talk about Hillary Clinton. It is not to talk about anything dealing with them, the cult of personalities, talking heads, whatever you want to call them. It has nothing to do with that. And because this could be a controversial topic, the opinions and views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent those of myself, my guests, or my employers, past, present, or future. I probably should have said that in the beginning. The disclaimer is in the show notes, but either way, this is one of those sensitive topics that I really want to make sure the bases are covered on. So, the first segment that we're going to talk about is going to be open source intelligence and social engineering as they relate to the election. The next segment will be the election and how it's playing into open source intelligence and social engineering. So, we're going to flip-flop. I'll just say we're going to flip the script on everything, but not quite the way that one would expect us to flip the said script. So, obviously, we're recording this on the 10th of November. The world still exists as we know it. We have, I don't know the exact number of days, but approximately 100 days until inauguration. So, do with that what you will. I'm not going to engage in that political discussion with regards to this podcast or at any time on the public forums. I may discuss it in a more intimate setting if someone so desires. Now that all that's out of the way, let's talk about how open source intelligence and social engineering specifically played into how they play into any election and how they played into this election. So what are your initial thoughts, Ed?
Well, I think that we are definitely moving into a new world where everything is a lot more open and revealed. So there are a lot of things that that candidates can use against each other from things that are available, publicly online. I guess undercover video probably doesn't count for that, but. You know, and some of these speeches that aren't supposed to be recorded and conversations that are supposed to be in private. I guess I'm not sure where that fits in the OSINT range of things. But basically, I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I kind of actually come from the school of thought that I kind of dismiss that as true OSINT. While you may gather it somewhere in a possible public forum, to me, that's kind of the lazy approach. That's more in line of like lazy surveillance or in some cases, illegal surveillance.
Right.
Which, I mean, the two do play into each other. Don't get me wrong. No one should quote me when in saying that surveillance does not play into open source intelligence, because if I said that, I would be an absolute liar and buffoon. But, you know, there comes a certain scope. The true heart of OSINT comes from you're using unconventional sources to gather data that could be used in whatever scenario. And, you know, in any election, we can always think about the mudslinging, you know, you find out this, you find out that. But, you know, talking about OSINT framework, for example, Justin Nordin's tool located at osintframework.com, there's a lot of really good stuff on here that could be used for gathering stuff about an election. So if you go to the tool and go to social networks and select Twitter, just for the sake of argument, you can follow up with location and mapping, and then from there, use the MIT map, the Harvard map, a tool called Creepy, which is a Python-based tool that you actually have to download, GeoChirp, TweetPaths. There's all kinds of tools about that. And what that can actually do, from the perspective of a potential candidate, that could actually allow them to determine what sentiments are popular in a given region. Mm-hmm. And I'll talk about why that's important on the other side of the coin in a moment, actually in the next segment. But, you know, and we always think about the mudslinging. Oh, candidate A found this out about candidate B, and they're going to release the information, and candidate B's political career is going to be over. You know, that could be the case. But also, from that same vein, candidates need to stop worrying about what the other candidate's doing from some regard, if we're going to talk about OSINT in the regards of campaigning, because they can find out so much more about their constituents. And to me, that's more important.
Yeah, there's a whole wealth of information out there on all of us. You know, if we're registered to vote, and whenever we've registered or voted in a primary, a lot of I think most states have a requirement that you declare a party or not. So there's that, and you know, there's a lot of other information. I'm sure that you know, these days, what I find interesting is that I feel like it used to be a tradition that people wouldn't reveal their political leanings or who they voted for, but that seems to be going, we seem to be going in a different direction where everybody's telling each other who they vote for, and, you know, they're really, you know, proud to declare their support for a candidate. So, you know, it's actually probably quite easy to find out a lot of people's political views just in, you know, from a broad view. Which I don't know. I don't know if that's a good thing or not, and I don't know how dangerous that can be. But it you know, if, as long as we live in a tolerant society, I think that's not a big deal. But you know, who knows what the future holds?
And that I couldn't agree more. So I'm playing with a couple of tools off the OSINT framework right now. So I'm actually doing a test about my own information, just to see how legitimate this is and exactly what I could do with this website, given that I know something. And oh boy, can I. So, with this being said, on the OSINT framework, I went to public records, voter records, and I didn't see a whole lot under voter records around where I am in Georgia. But in terms of voter registration data, I'm not going to tell you the exact rabbit hole that I went down, but I went down a few rabbit holes. I had to do a few clicking here and there to get to where I was going. But I was able to pull up my entire voting page, my full name, my mailing address, my race, my gender, status, and what day I registered, as well as my polling place. And then it actually, you know, I can request an absentee ballot. And honestly, yeah, this website it's an official website that allows people do official things in an official capacity. The problem is, using other aspects of OSINT, the information that it's explicitly asking for could be found anywhere.
Absolutely.
And what couldn't be found could be phished, really. And that's alarming about that kind of stuff. Alternatively, though, you know, there's even things to look at voter records, which, again, is pretty spooky. So, you know, keeping those things in mind, understanding who is where, that's a dangerous aspect. But I'm going primarily from the perspective of, hey, use the location and the mapping to understand the sentiments of the constituents so that you can adjust your campaign as necessary. Alternatively, if you're trying to court donations underneath this public records aspect of the OSINT framework, there's also a thing to look at campaign donation records as well. So again, you know, there's fun to be had there as well.
Yes, there is. I would like to think that that data is not going to lead to anything harmful, but there is so much of it out there that could be aggregated. And as security guys, we can't help but think that there's a danger to be, you know, to be seen or recognized if you have all this information out there.
Absolutely. And, you know, when you think about it from the grand scheme of things, we've already seen two voter registration databases attacked. One of them a little bit more successful than the other. But the problem that comes with this, right now, that is not considered to be protected data. It's not right. considered to be critical infrastructure or anything. And, you know, voter registration databases, you know, I'm not going to say that's critical infrastructure. The voting machines and the associated networks, yeah, you bet your pants. So, you know,
and
take that into account.
That should be a topic of a whole other podcast.
I tend to agree with you. But, you know, from that same vein as well, to go down that specific part of the rabbit hole, I almost wish that they would ask me for a spit sample or a blood sample or a hair follicle, because then that way it could become protected health information. And honestly, it would actually be mandated to be protected.
I think that's a great point.
And why is it not? I mean, the amount of data required allows me to build any sort of pretext, perform full-on identity theft. You know, honestly, there's nothing stopping me. The only thing that would stop me maybe is a social security number. But you know what? That's not hard to get either.
Right.
Because it's there. And, you know, to go back to what you were saying about, you know, people used to be private and secretive about who they were voting for. That's before we had people telling us their every move, their every, you know, forgive me for being a little crass with this, but, you know, we have people that tell us their every bowel movement. We see everything they eat. So we're able to predict their schedule. And that presents a whole new social engineering vulnerability in itself. But when people are oversharing this amount of data and nothing is considered sacred in that, from that vein, you know, the opportunity to really just have a blast per se, the opportunity is really high in that scenario.
Yeah. And there's a lot of vulnerability, I think, in having so much of our world through our devices. I was, you know, standing in line with a guy at my polling place, and I was, you know, watching him do research right there on his device. And I'm, you know, a lot of people just don't have time, and we're not going to take the time to make sure and vet the information that we're getting. So I just in this conversation we're having, I'm reminded that, you know, if I really wanted to, you know, mess with elections, I would definitely love to, you know, manipulate what people are seeing on their screens. If I can, you know, like this Ballotopedia or whatever site, you know, if I could influence what's on that site or change or modify whatever is over there, that would be a huge win. So I don't know. There's a lot of vulnerability that we're, you know, going to take on in the future with just the way our world is, and we're not catching up. I don't think we're catching up with our, you know, the way we do our you know, political stuff. Those voting machines alone are a big concern, I think.
And I couldn't agree more, because there's a few ways to think of this, right? I'm glad you brought the unrehearsed, coerced, organic segue out, because the next topic I was actually going to move us into is actually misinformation campaigns. Because, quite honestly, you know, that in this election, again, you know, disclaimer about all the stuff with Voldemort and Voldemort Jr., you know, running for office, Asteroid 2016. But, you know,
fear of death, yeah.
Exactly. But, you know, absent of that and absent of the mainstream media, because that's another rabbit hole I don't want to go down in terms of, you know, their role in the misinformation campaign, you know, going away from that, look at the other aspects of misinformation in this election. Just think of the things that you've seen yourself on social media that Donald Trump has said or Hillary has said or whatnot. And, you know, again, I don't care if it's true or false. That's not the debate at hand. The debate at hand is people are talking about this.
And that's all that matters sometimes.
If the right person says it, yeah. You know, people will follow and hinge on their every word, regardless. And I think that's a lot of reason why the politicians are always looking for some celebrity to court so that they have that person to speak to the masses. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking for it right now. I can't find it. So I don't know if I just didn't retweet it, I didn't like it, I didn't save it, or what, or I didn't screenshot it. But there was someone on a day or two before the election that was actually showing a couple of things. Like, they had Cali open and they were purporting that they had hacked into an election system in Alaska. Don't know how true it is. Again, you know, I just saw it. And then there was another one that claims that they were having issues casting anything for candidate X, and sure, then they did something and found a script that said, you know, the logic of it was if vote is cast for candidate Y, candidate Y plus one. Else, if vote cast for candidate X, candidate Y plus one. Mm. Which, obviously, that would have been far too obvious in the real grand scheme of the election. And, you know, I'm gonna while we're talking about tweets, I sent a tweet out around the election time frame that I thought was kind of funny. It didn't get as many likes and retweets as I expected, but I said that there was a new attraction coming for DEFCON 25. They were going to have an election village, and in this election village, they were going to have voting machine hacking and misinformation campaign capture the flag, or they could align it with the social engineering capture the flag. So, you know, in all reality, that could be a real thing.
I think that is a great idea. I think that we totally should go down that path, because as we're seeing, you know, this whole situation with our country and our politics is just getting more and more intense. You know, politics is increasingly driving a lot of what we're doing, and as the stakes get increased there, it's going to attract the bad guys, and it's going to attract people who are going to be nefarious. And it could be from, you know, the political parties. It could be from foreign actors. And if our community doesn't start to get on top of these things, you know, I think it is a concern what our information security, you know, situation is going to look like with regard to elections if we don't get on top of it.
Exactly. And, you know, you touched on state-sponsored hackers. So, you know, the Russian hackers are always going to be there. And depending on who's running next time, it could be the Chinese hackers, it could be North Korea, it could be Anonymous, it could be anybody. That's a threat. The 400-pound hacker is a threat, of course. But, you know, the reality of it is, you know, when I voted, I noticed a few opportunities for nefarious purposes. Dealing with like the cards to insert into the ballot machine to initialize it. There, you know, if you knew enough about the system, which it's not hard to find out, you could very easily create your own before you go and then just swap them out. And I didn't really pay a lot of attention to determine if someone was actually watching to see if I did that or not. Mm-hmm. But that's definitely something that could be done.
Absolutely. And I'm happy that that we're talking about this. One of the things that I've thought about, and I want to do more research on this, but I have often wondered what it is that actually gets written on those cards. I don't know if other states have it like we do in Georgia, but it's like a smart card that you insert into the machine, and it gets the voting data written to it, and then you just pass that card to the poll worker and they give you a sticker and you move on. But I don't know if there's a way to audit or verify the data that gets written on those cards. And I'm surprised that I haven't heard more of a outcry or a concern about that. So that's one of the things that I intend to dig into here in the next few weeks.
One word, awareness. Society is not aware that could be used as a vector. I mean, how about this? Instead of worrying about what's written on the card, worry about, could I copy any data off the card? Can I manipulate this data? And then at that point, you know, it's just like attacking Apple Pay. And, you know, right now, I don't think there's a known successful attack vector against Apple Pay. But that being said, you have such a short TTL on the packets that come from Apple Pay. And it's so focused that, you know, you basically have to have it right there. And my question would be, is it the same? Are these cards cryptographically protected? You know,
and it's all black box, closed source technology, as far as I know. And I guess that opens up, you know, the epic debate between open source and closed source. So,
well, I mean, it goes a lot deeper than that, because the same argument was put in place for the automobile industry. Oh, well, our code is so vital to human life, we're afraid to let any of those blimey nefarious hackers touch our stuff. And now, obviously, we're seeing Chrysler Fiat change their tune about it because they understand the value in a bug bounty program. And no, I'm not saying everybody has to have a bug bounty program because that's the cool thing to have. I mean, there's a lot of value to be found from a bug bounty program, but that's not everything. If they really wanted to do this, and they really wanted to show the American public that they were serious about it, they should take a page out of three different books and rewrite everything. And in these three books to take a page out of, you take the Chrysler Fiat page, because obviously, yeah, they're kind of in the same realm. The next page you take anything out of is Hack the Pentagon. And while Hack the Pentagon, in my opinion, did not necessarily go after the really critical sites, they did go after things that attackers would go after. So, you know, do that, and it shows the public that you're serious about it. And then the third book to take a page from would be Apple. They also have a bug bounty program. It pays out very, very well, which is good. But the thing about it, the caveat that goes with it, is you have to be invited to participate. That allows you to be vetted, non-disclosure agreements, all of that. And I think as long as they keep the door closed and keep the black box code running, I think that it's not doing any favors for the information security posture of our electoral system. With that being said, you know, to kind of start down the path of closing the door on this specific segment, that could do terrible things for voter confidence. Mm-hmm. For example, you know, and again, this is not my political lean, but I'm originally from Tennessee and I live and voted in Georgia. So with that being said, if in my home county in Tennessee, if I looked at the map and I saw that it was completely blue, I would immediately lose all faith in the voting system, because I know for a fact it's not going to be. I can almost tell you, for the most part, almost every Democrat in my hometown, not because I purposely go hang out with Democrats, or I avoid hanging out with Democrats, or I ask people if they're Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, Anarchist, or otherwise defined. I don't ask that question. It's just you kind of know because it's such a small town. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as long as we have the threat of someone attacking the electorate systems, the actual voting machines, and, you know, to some degree, I'm going to go ahead and redact my previous statement and say also the voter databases, just because of the amount of personal information that's in it. You know, when you have that lack of voter confidence, it's not doing a whole lot for public perception. Right. And I understand public perception is not everything, but, you know, if you want people to participate, they need to trust the process.
Right. And as we, as the younger generations that are more familiar with technology, they're going to be the ones that they're going to need to demand this stuff, because I think the older generation, forgive me for classifying them as such, I think a lot of the older generation is not as familiar with technology in general, and that includes, you know, the candidates that we had to choose from. I think that this is a problem pretty much across the board, and it's going to be with us for the next few elections at least. Maybe there's some hope in the next next few elections, but I would love to see somebody with some type of technical understanding, or, you know, at least somebody who grew up around technology, because I think once people start to gain an understanding of these things, we will have to demand greater transparency, and you know, we need more confidence in these systems. And I liked what you said about the bug bounty program. I would like to see if there's any research done on, you know, closed source proprietary software products that have been, you know, put through those rigors of a bug bounty program versus something that's open source. You know, there's different threats to both sort of models, but I think that it would be interesting to see, you know, if you know, the pros and cons of these two models, because we're going to need to, you know, to what you alluded to, have that assurance of our voting systems and our you know, how we express our political voice.
Most certainly, and you know, I'm going to summarize this segment as such to try to draw a slight comparison between this and the Internet of Things. Honestly, hello.
Sorry about that phone call. It's all silence now.
No problem. At least we weren't in class. If I were in class, I would have said, answer it on speakerphone. And every one of my students that's listening just started laughing because they know I'm not kidding. But, you know, to kind of draw a conclusion to this segment and, you know, draw that cross comparison with the Internet of Things, you know, a lot of people are calling for a cyber underwriter's lab to have a minimal amount of security and give it a seal of approval. And while I don't necessarily think that the government may be the best entity to do that,
right?
Reference OPM, reference CIA.gov, right. Reference insert agency that got popped here. I don't think that that's necessarily a good idea for that regard, but I like the idea in its bare principle. And, you know, from that vein, something, you know, we now have a CISO appointed, which, granted, by my understanding, he reports directly to the president and has no subordinates. So basically, it looks like it's one of those positions where in the corporate world, it's like a bunch of managers are playing golf and they're like, hey, I got a security guy. It's like, what does he do? He does security. Well, what's that? I don't know. It just sounded cool. I got one. So, you know, oh, I got a CISO too. And, you know, that may be the case. It may not be the case. And I'm not, you know, devaluing the role of the federal CISO, but based on my comprehension, that's what it appeared to be. With that being said, you know, the final nail in the coffin with this segment is, it's funny because just before we recorded, I was browsing Twitter and I saw someone joking that the 2020 election was going to be Mark Cuban of Shark Tank fame, mm-hmm. A tech entrepreneur versus Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
maybe we'll get that. Maybe we'll get my maybe my wish will come true that we get it. We get a tech aware. Maybe even security aware, security conscious.
Be careful what you wish for. Be right. Careful what you wish for, because if you recall, who ran on the Libertarian ticket in primaries.
Oh, John McAfee.
Yeah, so be careful what you wish for. No disrespect to John, but...
Oh, yeah. We love John.
Everybody has, you know, everybody has that crazy uncle. But, you know, with that being said, we kind of saw it already in this election to some degree. The cyber being, I know, take a drink. The cyber being part of the concern. And any chance I got to really engage candidates on Twitter, which they never responded, but any chance I got, I was like, hey, what is your cybersecurity strategy? And that, you know, WikiLeaks, I don't support what WikiLeaks does by principle. There are good outcomes from what WikiLeaks does, but there are also bad outcomes. So I'm not, you know, I'm just going to distance myself from that completely. But, you know, this election particularly, between WikiLeaks, Clinton's email server, of course, the Podesta emails, which is a great example of why people need phishing awareness, coupled with right before the election, the giant denial of service against Brian Krebs and the denial of service against Din, you know, that right there tells you everything you need to know about cybersecurity. So, you know, it started to become important in this election. And, you know, I was looking through some old tweets today, and at B-Sides Augusta, someone asked Rob Joyce, the leader of NSA's Tailored Access Operations Unit, basically their red team, the U.S. He's basically the chief of the U.S.'s state-sponsored hacking team. They asked him what the biggest threat to information security was going to be, and he said, without hesitation, by the year 2020, our biggest threat is going to be the Internet of Things. Mm-hmm. And that was before this giant denial of service. So, you know, he embodies that whole idea, that as an information security professional, you almost have to be clairvoyant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, with that being said, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to discuss the election and how it's going to play into open source intelligence and social engineering as well. So stay tuned.
Are you subscribed to this podcast? If not, please do so on iTunes and at advancedpersistentsecurity.net/podcast.
Attention security professionals. Have you been looking for a community of only security experts? Look no further. PeerList is here. PeerList helps you stay on top of the news by creating personalized feeds where you get posts from your community and blogs from top industry bloggers, all customized to your specific interests. No more email lists to discuss a topic with other experts. You can invite specific people to any discussion as well as contribute to any discussion on PeerList. Build your reputation by creating a profile and contributing content that will help others see your expertise. The better your content is, the higher you rank. PeerList never gives your information to any vendor. You are not a lead. You are a professional. Check out PeerList today at peerlist.com. PeerlyST.com.
And we're back. So we've discussed some news with regards to OAuth and Signal. We've went over how open source intelligence, social engineering, and misinformation kind of led into the election, some of the things that happened during the election, and some friendly advice for lawmakers in terms of voting security, as well as some open source methods for candidates to learn more about their constituents, which may actually make the world a better place. So now we're going to shift gears. As I said earlier, we're recording this on November 10th, so the election is over. So now we have to worry about something else. And for this, I've written a blog post about it. I'm not sure if I'm going to be publishing it on Advanced Persistent Security site or another venue. There is another outlet that may pick it up. I'm just waiting for an official word tomorrow. So with that being said, watch my Twitter for that. I will share it. I'll share it on the Advanced Persistent Security Twitter as well. So just keep in mind that this is not a venue about debating or arguing about the candidates, winners, losers, or politics in general. To reiterate, the opinions and views voiced in this podcast do not reflect those of Ed or my employers, past, present, or future, or any other organization that we're duly affiliated with. So, you know, at this point, it's time to talk about the backlash. And not the backlash in terms of misinformation, because that's going to continue. It's just a staple of life. Now we have to be on the lookout for malware, hoaxes, and phishing campaigns focused around the election. So when I wrote the blog post, I hadn't observed anything yet, but I knew it was coming. A lot of people are very passionate and emotional about it. A lot of people are very vocal about it, as we talked about earlier. And, you know, when you talk about the core of social engineering, you're really trying to do one of two things: elicit an action or information. In this, you can play off of someone's emotions and use one of the six tenets of social engineering: urgency, as well as the status quo, and scarcity, to get someone to fall for this. And because it's all up in our face, you log into social media, that's all you're going to see. You really can't avoid it. So, you know, I'll talk a little bit on the broad scope of a couple or a few scenarios for both Hillary and Donald. And then I'm going to loop back around and tell you what I saw today. So, you know, obviously, there's going to be people who oppose Trump, and there's people who support Hillary, and there's the Venn diagram of both. And it just happens. And in that regard, at some point, they're going to try to get you to sign up for a mailing list or some website with some juicy information. And, you know, they're going to try to get you to perform the action. It's playing to your emotions and so on. And, you know, here's a few things that I thought up that really could play into this. I'm just going to go over them very briefly. The first would be a loophole that allows her to win. You will notice there's an asterisk next to that. I'll get to that in a moment. Something alleging that Donald Trump was killed or arrested or otherwise incapacitated, disqualified from presidency. Something alleging that President Obama may intervene. Again, place an asterisk next to that. A condition that warrants a recount with enough swing or significance to sway the outcome. Again, another asterisk. And a claim of a cyber attack or other form of misinformation campaign. So that's for Hillary. For Donald, it's a lot of the same stuff, but, you know, it's really going with just the jubilation of winning. For those people who aren't necessarily pro-Trump, even though there are the pro-Trump and the anti-Hillary crowd. And, you know, some of these campaigns might be something allowing you to share your support on social media, which is a double attack since it'll get your credentials. And then something about Clinton being killed or arrested, something in line with her emails, WikiLeaks, the FBI, Secretary of Justice, whatever. You know, just keep in mind that you should only look at reputable news sources and reputable outlets, absent of all the other bias with the media. You should look at that kind of stuff when you're observing this. So to talk about what I saw today, there was a link going around. It was from someone purporting to be ABC News. The URL, the main domain that it was on, was abcnews.com.co. So it looked legit. It was probably one of the best URLs I've seen in a phishing attack yet. So what it purported, notice all these asterisks, it said that President Obama had signed an executive order demanding a recount, and based on that, popular vote was going to be taken into account, and that would provide the loophole for Hillary to win. Wow. People were taking it hook, line, and sinker. It just kept on getting shared. It was just growing exponentially. And I wish I could have got this blog post out just a little bit earlier, but, you know, I saw it coming. Ed, what are your thoughts?
You know, I like that. I like that abc.com.co. I think that is a great way to get past people's, you know, initial defenses. And as long as you see enough of, you know, the URL looking legit, I think that our brains can kind of turn off. At least for a lot of people. I know that for us, maybe in the tech field, we're maybe a little bit more focused on the details like that. But, you know, we're talking about masses of people that don't have that attention to detail, or maybe they're, you know, something as simple as your vision just isn't as good. And, you know, there's a lot of text packed on these tiny screens, you know, or maybe even on the phone. It's just not something that your brain actually sees. So I love that. I love that attack, that kind of attack that you know, uses something that is easily noticed, but, you know, maybe to us, but to those people that might be vulnerable to it, they're not gonna see that. And yeah, as far as the types of information that it wants to pull from you, I do think that is a concern. Like you said, when people are trying to do solicitations for some type of support or signing a petition or something like that, it can seem innocuous. It can seem like something that's routine, that, you know, you've done this before, and it's actually not, you know, the change.org or whatever kind of petition site, just as an example. So yeah, that's a cool one.
It was a really crafty one. And I mean, it's the first of many to come. I'm sure there are more. I've heard stories about some saying that Donald Trump had a heart attack and died. I'm sure people are going to start taking images from the new Marilyn Manson music video that has a man who some people say looks like Donald Trump that is laying beheaded in the floor. There's no head, so it really doesn't look like Donald Trump. It's just a guy in a suit. If Marilyn Manson's your thing. But without regard to that, I mean, it's coming. And, you know, as we as a society evolve, I think it's just going to kind of continue. And we're just going to see a lot of social engineering campaigns come out of it. And, you know, they're going to play to the pretext based on someone's political leanings. And as we alluded to earlier, a lot of people are very overt about their politics in social media outlets, which allow us to build really good pretexts to, if you will, get in character and obtain their trust.
And yes, absolutely. I think a lot of people, once they find that they're in agreement with you, or once you find that you agree mostly with somebody, it does make you drop your guard down a lot. And I totally agree with you that this is a great way, if I were an attacker, to try to go after someone and spearfish them or what have you.
And honestly, we're just leaving ourselves wide open for it. That's why, as a general policy on Facebook, I have very strict access controls in terms of who can see what I post. I very rarely, if ever, comment or like anything publicly. I pitch a fit when I get tagged in a public post. I'm really not a fan of getting tagged in posts, period. But I do that because I don't want people to know too much about me. And, you know, I've not read Michael Basil's Hiding from the Internet yet, but it's definitely on my reading list. I may recommend it for Brian Brake's book club that he's running. Stay tuned for more information about that. There could be a Breaking Down the Advanced Persistent Security Holiday Party and Book Club Kickoff podcast in the near future. With a very important guest that may or may not have already been booked. But with that regard, you know, I've not read Hiding from the Internet, but if I were to assume, this would be part of the core tenet of that. Assuming that the book is not telling you just to get off of social media, which, knowing Michael Basil and the fact, I don't know him personally, but knowing his persona and the fact that it's near impossible, if not completely impossible, to find a picture of him. And he doesn't allow photography in his classes for that reason, or photography with him after his classes. You know, if he were going to say, if you have to be on social media, I think that's what he would say.
And I know that Richard Stallman, just to give him a shout out, says very similar things about how, you know, Facebook is a facial recognition engine, and you know, friends don't send pictures of each other to you know, facial recognition services like Facebook or whatever. I've definitely been thinking about his talk that I can send in the show notes or whatever. But he's got a great talk about threats to internet freedom, and I love some of the thought provoking things that he says. Don't always agree with everything he says, but found him to be fascinating in that talk.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, we're becoming in a society of oversharers. Yes. And I think that really needs to change because to wrangle this back into the election and political perspective, it just leaves us too open for people to learn enough about us to really do those dangerous things. And for that, I think we really need to reform it.
Yes, and that's only going to come from guys like us once once our generation of security and tech aware individuals like ourselves are in positions of government and power and politics and everything in between.
Maybe not necessarily in positions of authority, power, and politics, but if we can get someone aware elected that would create that right task force, or even perhaps break down the whole paradigm of federal employees not getting paid as much as private business employees, so that they can attract that better talent. Because when you look at government information security, it is hands down a compliance driven framework as opposed to security driven. And I'm not saying that compliance is not important in the non-government sectors, because I mean, if that were the case, then we wouldn't have Sarbanes-Oxley, Gramm-Leach-Bliley, HIPAA, and PCI. But you have organizations that take proactive steps to be secure outside of the scope of how do I remain compliant? And that's one of the fundamental problems. And I'm not even going to go down the rabbit hole of I wish the federal government would allow people to smoke pot, because, you know, that's a whole new argument for a whole new day. But I think that, you know, there are a lot of people who would be willing to work for, say, FBI, Secret Service, NSA, as an information security analyst, as a red teamer, or whatever, if their use of marijuana was not held against them. And I'm not saying that they should be allowed to smoke while employed or smoke right on the job, but with the FBI, if I recall correctly, if you admit to smoking marijuana, you're disqualified for it's either 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, I heard you mention that on a previous podcast, and I thought that was really interesting, and I do agree with you on that. I think that that is going to have to be one of the cultural shifts that we sort of, you know, become a little bit more tolerant of people that, you know, might have done some partying in college or in their 20s or whatever. But I totally agree, you know, if I don't know about 5 years or whatever, but, it's... You know, I don't know what their reasoning is for that. Maybe there's some reasoning that I'm, you know, unaware of.
I used to know, but I don't remember anymore. So, you know, I've transitioned away from the government world. Now that I'm working for a private consulting firm, we do have government clients, but that's not our core business. So with that being said, you know, it's going to take a significant paradigm shift. I'm not saying that you should allow someone who can't pass urinalysis the position, but right, you know, it's out of your system in say 30 days or whatever. I don't remember the thumb rule, but you know, the reality of it is 5 years is excessive. And what makes it worse, you know, when you look at pharmaceuticals, and I'm definitely catching myself go down the wrong rabbit hole that's completely off topic to information security. But when you talk about people that are, you know, on prescription medications, you know, some of those are just as dangerous, if not more dangerous, assuming there is any danger to marijuana.
Yeah. And I don't know how much of that's going to show up on a drug test and or the different kinds that they have, you know, hair follicle or whatever. But yeah, I definitely think there's a lot of stuff out there that's dangerous, and it's not just, yeah, and like you said, nobody, you know, is going to try to justify, you know, being intoxicated on the job or even on the weekends, depending on how, you know, if it's like a brain surgeon or something, you don't want him doing that kind of partying on the weekends, or even on the weekends. So yeah, like you said, the paradigm shift, I think, is going to come at some point, and hopefully we can manage to get qualified people in those positions.
I couldn't agree more. And let's go ahead and start the conclusion of this segment. And, you know, let's look at it from this perspective. Analysts are saying that we're going to have fewer information security professionals than we have positions by the year 2020. And obviously with millennials, they're a completely different creature than Gen X and baby boomers. So in that regard, you know, you've got to look at things like visible tattoos, tattoos on the neck, tattoos on the hands, sleeves, recreational marijuana use. They like to dye their hair. They like to get weird haircuts. Those, you know, gauges. I'm not a fan of the gauges, but, you know, they exist. And, you know, I'm not going to say that society should just bend over and allow them to do whatever, but at the same time, you know, we have to be somewhat understanding of that, because honestly, there's no one to blame for how millennials are, except for society and their parents. You know, the same thing goes for Generation X, for baby boomers, for the greatest generation. It's all a product of their parenting, the parenting they received. And, you know, that's just that's something we're going to have to look at. And I'm glad that industry is seeing this, but, you know, government not so fast. When I was a government employee, granted, I was a very loud-mouthed 25-year-old. And, you know, you want to talk about having a chip on your shoulder and being somewhat arrogant? Okay, very arrogant. That was me. You know, I was a GS-12, I was 25, and I was not afraid to tell you I was a 25-year-old GS. A GS-12 at that. I was not afraid to. But the thing about it was, it wasn't very well received. And then once the summer months came and I started wearing polos and I have tattoos visible on my forearm, it changed.
That's interesting. I'll have to check out your tattoos sometime.
Maybe. We'll see. They're nothing really great. But either way, you know, with it, it's just something we have to be ready to evolve. And, you know, you can either evolve or you can stagnate. And, you know, right now, America is at a crossroads that needs to make that decision and do it quickly.
Yeah, and I think what it sounds like is that are we going to become a meritocracy where we judge our, you know, qualification based on our performance and our ability to get the job done, or are we going to, you know, look for those softer ways of evaluating people that, you know, that I guess have traditionally been done, like the interview and the, you know, the drug test and the, you know, do they fit the, what we, you know, whatever we're considering the culture to be, you know, the popular culture to be. And I think the tattoos are the first, you know, sort of foot in that door. I think that the tattoos and the dyed hair, you know, at least as far as I can tell, I think that that's, you know, been accepted for a long time. I don't know about in the government sector though, but, and, you know, not for every role, not for every job, but I'd like to think the tech industry is pretty tolerant of that sort of thing. But yeah, we're a shifting culture in society right now.
Exactly. And, you know, my parting words with this would be, I can understand about covering visible tattoos whenever you're dealing with clients and you're client facing, but when you're, especially as an information security guy, if you're basically hanging out in a sock, you know, honestly, I don't even understand the need for business casual. Okay, corporate dress code, sure, whatever. But if you're never going to interact with clients except via phone or email, honestly, if it were socially acceptable, I would be cool with those guys coming to work in their underwear.
Or pajamas. Well, let's go with pajamas.
For some people, they're the same. But okay. Anyway, you know, with that being said, I think we're at a tipping point that we may see a lot of changes for the better. And on that note, let's go ahead and take our final break. And when we come back, you can tell us how to contact you, say your parting words of wisdom, and then we'll say goodbye. Stay tuned.
Don't forget to check out our blog at advancedpersistentsecurity.net/blog. Follow us on Twitter at @ADVPersistentSEC and follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/advancedpersistentsecurity.
And we're back from our final break. This episode has been myself and Ed Porter, Ed in Atlanta, local to Atlanta. We've been discussing both the open source intelligence and social engineering as it pertains to the election, as well as the election and how it pertains to social engineering and open source intelligence. With that, we also did some quick discussion about OAuth and Signal. We've had a really good discussion. We went down a few rabbit holes, but we kind of caught ourselves before it was too late and pulled ourselves back. With that being said, I guess now it's time for you to say goodbye, Ed. So tell us how we can contact you if you want to be contacted. Tell us, you know, anything that's pertinent for everyone to know, any website or blog or anything you're maintaining, any parting words of wisdom, and then we'll say goodbye.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to be on with you. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on pretty much all social media. I'm Ed Porter, CISSP on LinkedIn, and at EdinATL on Twitter. And I have EdinATL, EDINATL at Gmail, but I'm setting up, I've got an EdPorter678 at Gmail for professional work stuff. You know, my first account is starting to get a little backed up, but yeah, I'm out there pretty much everywhere. Ed in Atlanta spelled out on Facebook, and you know, you can do your OSINT on me there.
I will be most happy to gather as much OSINT as possible and exploit it for my own gains. I will know where you voted.
You know, that's one of the things I didn't put anything out about. So you know,
it doesn't matter.
Well, it's out there if you dig deep enough.
Cool. And with that being said, you know, it's always a pleasure having you here. You know, you were on one of the lost episodes before we shifted to this platform.
I think that was a blessing in disguise for me, at least.
I don't know, because that episode, there was just a lot of really good information, you know, just for the listeners' comprehension. It was Ed, myself, and Tracy Maley of the InfoSec Sherpa, and we were just doing a crash course in OSINT, and honestly, there was a ridiculously good conversation that came from it, and then when I went to edit it, the audio was just so bad, I couldn't slap my name on it. I should have found this solution sooner. I'm using ZenCaster now, which is a cloud-based solution. I'm not endorsed by them, but if you're interested in podcasting and you don't want to worry about doing a lot of the editing, post-production, and all of that fun stuff, and you don't want to deal with Skype and all of those tools, definitely check out ZenCaster. Because, I mean, I lost that episode with you guys. I lost one with Justin Nordeen, and I started recording one with Kimberly Crawley, and the same thing happened, so we just aborted it. Anyone who listened to the B-Sides Atlanta episode with Martin Fisher, they heard the same thing. And for that, I continue to apologize. All I can do is hope that this ZenCaster solution is way better. I've upgraded my hardware. I've upgraded my microphone. I've got a windscreen, a pop filter. I'm using a mixing board now. So I hope the audio quality is better for the listeners. Please send your feedback to podcast@advancedpersistentsecurity.net or hit us on Twitter at @ADVPersistSec. You can hit me with the same information on Twitter at C3PJoe. That is C, the letter C, underscore 3PJoE. And we can. I'll be more than happy to discuss it with you. If you like this, be sure to give it a favorable rating or like it, love it, 5 stars on iTunes and all other platforms such as Google Play, Stitcher, and what have you. Stay tuned. Like I said, I am in talks to collaborate with Brian Brake and the Breaking Down Security podcast crew, possibly Mr. Betcher as well, to do a joint episode to kick off Brian's book club, tentatively giving it the working title. This is just my own working title. I don't know if we're going to stick with this one. The Breaking Down the Advanced Persistent Security podcast holiday special and book kickoff episode. So stay tuned for that. That should be coming towards, I would say, mid to late December. So definitely stay tuned. We've got a pretty major guest lined up. We're going to be talking some pretty epic stuff. So with that being said, we'll go ahead and wrap up this episode. And until next time, stay secure.
Thank you for listening to the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast. Until next time, stay secure and don't forget to subscribe to this podcast.